I'm Katarina, who's let me know if anything doesn't work right or whatever, I'm sure I'll help with the problems if there's any issues. I myself am a doctoral student in the linguistics program here at Stony Brook, so I'm very much interested in saying how you do language, and that's why I'm here. And I'm just going to give you little words about yourselves as an introduction for each of you. So Jacqueline Preston is going to be a first presenter, and she's a doctoral candidate in English, composition, and rhetoric at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her research examines the hermeneutical and rhetorical processes involved in negotiating rhetorics with individuals who move between well-spoken communities. Her work has been presented at numerous national conferences and accepted for publication in journals such as Community Literacies. Her dissertation, entitled Collective Persuasions, History, Memory, and Rhetoric, examines how collective rhetorics function as dialectical spaces, and mediators of change. Her research interests are directed towards building classrooms as an academic culture that makes room for all students to participate actively in sharing their social, civic, and academic communities. And she's going to be presenting on collective rhetorics, histories, tropes, schemes, and ideographs in rural communities. Thank you so much.
So I will say up front, I'm not a linguist, so I will be very interested in your feedback. So I'm going to go ahead and pack up these are some transcript of conversations, so that you'll have them and there are options for later in the presentation.
Is the lighting good?
Or
you want to dark down? That would be great, I think.
Another remote? So the work that I'm presenting today is in reference to a longitudinal study that I began actually in the summer of 2008. And I consider myself a member of each of the two communities under study. I spent my childhood in one and then my adult life in the other. And my interest in this project is connected to my experience as a writing instructor for first year composition students, and then also as an assistant director to the first year composition program in Madison, as well as my personal experience as a student and scholar of rural working class origins. And over the last 3 years, I've positioned myself as an ethnographer to better understand the role rhetoric and community play in the academic growth of college students. Specifically, the aim of this ethnography is to examine what I'll refer to as collective rhetorics. These are systems of persuasion and identification informed by and manifested in a shared identity particular to a community, its histories, cultural artifacts, and the linguistic actions of a group taken up in the context of those communities. In lieu of those studies that focus on how similar language reproduce existing ideologies, I hope to illuminate what is often overlooked as how language and symbols function to mediate sociocultural change. By examining not only history and memory, but also talk, this study demonstrates how the collective linguistic actions taken up by the group in the context of a particular social history both reflect and disturb the collective rhetorics of the community. The research for this work takes place in two rural communities in southern Ohio, and they're approximately a 35 minutes drive from one town to the other. Based on median income, education, and occupation, Johnston Courthouse, a manufacturing farming community, could be described in terms of its class basis, working class, collectively, and Dower Springs, a small artisan college town, as collectively middle class. I'll begin here by exploring what makes up the social history of these two communities in an effort to call attention to the way a community's history and its common narrative shape the grain of the community's cultural identity, as well as to provide a context for examining these collective rhetorics as dialectical spaces, that is, mediators of change. So, and I want to say up front that one of the points of confusion is sometimes that I'm talking about cultural identity, and that doesn't necessarily mean that individual members of the community reflect directly the cultural identity of the community. And so if you can keep that in your mind as I'm talking, because I think, you know, we keep thinking, oh, these individuals, this may not be true for them, but it's the cultural identity of the community. Mm-hmm. So Johnston Courthouse was originally settled by Virginia War veterans, and who received the land from the federal government as payment for their service in the American Revolutionary War. The town existed primarily to meet the needs of these surrounding farmers who brought their crops and livestock to the village to sell. And despite that the economic base of Johnston is today rooted primarily in manufacturing, residents continue to refer to Johnston as a farming community. And then a cultural identity that's reinforced by rituals, such as the annual Scarecrow Festival, that's a flyer one, that takes place in September. Cultural artifacts such as the large murals placed in the city limits, at the city limits where each of the major county roads winds its way into town. And the picture on the left is an example of one of those murals. Commissioned by the city, or like that, it's the same artist, and so these paintings are all over town. This one was in the Commerce Department there. So they're billboard size, created by a local artist, and they depict structures that are easily identifiable, such as the courthouse and local churches. And they're alongside in collage-like, often, cornfields and barns and grain silos. So, and also the country fair that dresses the store windows, especially during harvest, and references to farm are common on the local radio and in casual conversation from the local restaurants. So here, terms such as land and nature are associated with crops and weather conditions typically. For example, a dry spell, good rain, all of which sustain in this community what Alda Leopold references in the Sand County Almanac as an Abrahamic concept of the land, an understanding of the land that's primarily utilitarian, agrarian, a commodity which belongs to us. So when we compare these attitudes and frames of acceptance to those common to the community of Dowry, we begin to see how distinctively social histories shape our social realities. Like Johnston Courthouse, Dowry Springs, geographically close but culturally distinct, was established in the first decade of the 19th century as well. However, in sharp contrast to the descriptions of Johnston, a small and safe, conservative farming community, residents of Dowry described their community as a small hippie town. Eclectic, civic-minded, and diverse. So rainbow flags, Buddhas, an annual art festival, and murals celebrating diversity reinforce a cultural identity that not only reflects the nostalgia of the 60s and 70s, but also a social history that's unique to this place. Dowry Springs originated in 1825 when 100 Owenite families settled in the area, hoping to create a socialist utopian community. And this is just, this was, oh, yes. And so this is, these are some scenes from around town. You can see how very different it is. And then, unlike the Virginia settlers, the Owenites owned their property communally and based their economy on the cooperative ideal of socialist philosophy. Though the Owenite community failed, town grew as people moved into the area seeking the healing waters of the springs that are located close by, and it's also after which the town received its name. In contrast to tropes of the land that characterize Johnston, references to land heard in Dowry often evoke images of wilderness, tropes reflective of a social history closely tied to romantic considerations of nature, wherein the land is valued as a source of spiritual renewal rather than for its utilitarian function. Terms used in association with the land, like environment and nature, arise most often in the context of rhetoric today around social movements such as environmentalism and peat oil, which are really strong in this community, which counter frames of acceptance or attitudes that would posit the land as a possession. Such artifacts and attitudes comprise what Hans Osman refers to as cultural memory, a term to address the collective knowledges and constructions of the distant past. Austin's cultural memory is a concept that builds on Maurice Halbwachs' idea of collective memory, arguing that like language, memory is a social phenomenon, a repertoire of generator of semiotic configurations that transcend the span of a lifetime and shape a community's cultural identity. While Halbwachs' collective memory underscores the cognitive discrepancy between the historical reconstruction, that is, the collective knowledges of the past and the lived experience of the tradition, Osmond's cultural memory highlights the narratives manifested in the medial conditions, the cultural representations, writing, image, architecture, architecture legitimizing the past, those cultural artifacts that groups use to construct patterns of self-interpretation and belonging. To more deeply explore how a cultural memory informs self-interpretation and a sense of belonging, I asked participants if there was a common historical narrative that was shared by residents in these two respective communities. So part of the larger project, I began to explore how these narratives were taken up in each of the communities in talk, text, and other symbolic representations to understand better how, in addition to tropes of the divine and the land, which I've spoken of, tropes of the other contribute to the collective memory of these two communities. To illustrate, I'll turn first to a splattering of bullet holes that are found in the heavy oak doors of Johnston's courthouse. Though Johnston Courthouse received its unusual name as a way of distinguishing it from other municipalities in the same postal area, the addition of courthouse to Johnston bides well, not only because the palatial-like courthouse sits directly in the center of town, taking up half a block, but also because it holds in its doors a story common to most who live here. When asked about the history of this place, most residents point to the bullet holes left in the wooden doors of one of the main entrances. The holes are the remains of what archive newspapers and older residents refer to as the race riot of 1894, the attempted lynching of William Dolby, an African-American man, when he was accused of raping one of the members of a more prominent family in the community. When a crowd of 2,000 gathered on the courthouse steps refused to disperse, National Guards that were called in by McKinley fired shots from within the courthouse, killing five men. Today, photographs of the riot hang in Johnson Sheriff's Office and are posted on their website. Local pictorials include images of the riot and speak of it as a dark day in the county's history. In contrast to the history referred to by residents of Johnston, the common historical narratives recalled by residents of Dowry Springs is of its place in abolitionist history as the last stop on the Underground Railroad, particularly the story of Waylon Gaunt, who was a former slave, who after having bought his freedom, settled in the community and prospered. In the same year that the riot at Johnston Courthouse was cited in the local news, Gaunt's death was chronicled in the Springs Herald. Gaunt had, in his will, bequeathed a tract of land to the town of Dowry, the income of which was to be distributed to needy widows each year on Christmas. This is still done today. And today, a park has been named in tribute to Gaunt, and monuments and plaques stand in honor of his contribution to the community and the local histories. Books and websites continue to celebrate his name. Residents cherish this history and continue to think of their own town as diverse and eclectic. I note the two historical narratives specifically because they have been taken up by the community as central to each of a received history and have informed in curious ways the cultural identities of each. So memorialized in parks and monuments, included in local pictorials and cited in newspapers, as mentioned, like tropes of the divine and the land, tropes of the other emerge that imagine the relationship between white Euro-Americans and African-Americans distinctively in each of the two communities. These histories thus provide a context for and inform not only the cultural identity of each community, but also contribute to the shared rhetorics of each of these places. Johnston's history as a farming community is connected to a concept of the land as utilitarian and agrarian, and as I mentioned, the residents identify this place as a close-knit community. Its imagined political economy, or sexual political economy, is rooted in commerce, private property, and rhetorics of land that are utilitarian, not communal. It bears a history that brands the town as white, conservative, antagonistic to those that are different, and while in contrast to Dowry's history, has informed a community. In contrast, Dowry's history has informed a community whose identity is imagined as nature-beloved, communal, and eclectic. While a good portion of my larger project is devoted to drawing parallels between the community's social history and its cultural identity and dominant rhetorics, my interest is not to argue a kind of historical determinism. Instead, I wish to examine the rhetorics of the community as situated within its particular socio-historical context, specifically to highlight the tensions inherent to the scene. So that is the cultural identity of the community. And let me say that again. The tension is inherent to the scene. So that is the cultural identity of the community. And the actors, those who regard themselves as members in the study, students and their parents. So cultural memory and its counterpart, cultural identity, are treated here as a kind of third party with which members of the community routinely negotiate a relationship, both aligning themselves with and positioning themselves against. Cultural memory thus functions in relationship to collective rhetoric as a kind of fertile commonplace. So this is the model to follow. What Kenneth Burke calls a vocabulary motive. So Burke's vocabulary motive does not refer to underlying motive in the Freudian sense, but how language reflects intentionally the ideologies that are common to a place. So that vocabulary of motive is sustained by modes of persuasion, including tropes, metaphorical language, ideographs, absolute or ultimate terms representing widely shared beliefs, and schemes, changes in ordinary word patterns. So the idea is that members of a community would draw upon a vocabulary of motives as kind of a way to identify with one another. All of which are acquired and used by members of a social system to not only reproduce and secure familiar symbolic configurations, but also, as I hope to demonstrate here, as dialectical spaces of ambiguity within which social realities have the potential to shift and transform. So Osman reminds us that cultural memory and the use we make of it are determined not merely by our past, but our intercourse with others, by language, action, communication, by our emotional ties to the configurations that shape our social reality. The ways in which cultural memory reinforce and reproduce ideologies is well documented in the theoretical works of Perdue and others. The sociolinguistic processes by which ideologies are reinforced can be found in a number of studies in critical discourse analysis as well. In the following observation, I hope to call attention to the dialectical processes by which those frames of acceptance are disturbed and rhetorics are renegotiated, reconstructed, inverted, and transposed. So as part of this study, I interviewed 12 college students, 6 from each community, and held focus groups with students and their parents. Preliminary findings suggest that while talk between college students and their parents engaged the collective rhetorics reflective of the belief system shared by the community in ways that reinforce and reproduce symbolic configurations, these rhetorics also function as dialectical spaces, media of change in service to an exigence. So the term exigence is used by Lloyd Bitzer to describe a rhetorical situation. So wherein a speaker seeks to resolve the situation through rhetorical discourse, recognizing the normative claims embedded in collective rhetoric as based not on things as they are, but on interpretations of situations. So exigence in this can be understood here as a perceived imperfection in the group's current understanding of social reality. So something feels amiss, and I'll get to the example to become a little bit more clear. One that motivates the interlocutors to alter their interpretations. This process is not one achieved in isolation, but it's a social process, what I'll refer to here as social recalcitrance in reference to Burke's use of the term recalcitrance. Recalcitrance refers to the factors that substantiate a statement, the factors that incite a statement, and the factors that correct a statement. So thus, recalcitrance is both a thing to be overcome as well as a method of overcoming, of correcting. Social recalcitrance can be understood as a dialectical process, a remedial process by which members of a social network engage in rhetorical discourse, persuasion, and identification. Underlying this discourse is the aim to achieve a unified conception of reality appropriate to a changing situation. The mechanism by which social recalcitrance takes place is comprised of linguistic acts that function rhetorically to invert and restructure configurations of the social reality generally held by the members of the group. The following transcript is taken from data collected during a conversation I observed in Johnston Courthouse between 3 female college students and their mothers. I've chosen this conversation specifically to demonstrate how collective rhetorics of the other function as a dialectical space of mediation. By examining modes of persuasion used in talk, I identified the following rhetorical strategies used by the group to facilitate what I've referred to as social recalcitrance. So reclassification, a device used to reorder by moving properties of one class to another. Negation, statements of denial. And correctio, or repair, a linguistic device demonstrating the correction. Each of these linguistic moves function here as devices used to renegotiate and transpose the dominant rhetorics of community clustered around what they're talking about here is being gay. A relative is gay. Detailed in the following observation, which you have a transcript in front of you if you want to get that. Yeah. I note how